Hi, Josh.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How you doing?
I'm not too bad. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Josh Hammer, globetrotting foreign correspondent. Currently, I think, in Germany,
where you live.
Is that
yes,
right? In Berlin. And, of course, the longtime Blogging Heads viewers may recall that the most interesting biographical fact about you is that you've been abducted not once but twice by Islamic extremists, I think once in Iraq and the other time either in Gaza or the West Bank.
In Gaza,
right?
Correct. Uh-huh. Not yet in Berlin.
Uh-huh.
But so, the Bader-Meinhof gang appears to be quiet these days.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Good.
So I hope it stays that way. And remind me, if I'm ever traveling, not to go to you for tips about like what hotels to stay at and stuff, okay?
For some reason, nobody's asked me that for the last 7 years. I mean, nobody's asked me for hotel tips.
No travel tips
at all. No, nobody's ever come to me with tips or travel advice.
I wonder why.
I don't know that, yeah.
So, I wanted to talk to you because I realized after the presidential election that for the last couple of months, I had paid basically no attention to events beyond America's borders, and I wanted you to...
I haven't paid much attention either, actually.
Even in Germany, is that right?
No, I mean, everybody has been riveted by the American election, overseas, especially in boring Germany, where the politics never changes no matter who's in power here.
So is it different now saying that you're an American when you're abroad? Do you say it with pride now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of universal right now. I mean, the day after the election, there were... I did not see it myself, but a friend of mine told me on Bergmannstrasse, which is one of the main drags in sort of the funky Kreuzberg neighborhood filled with restaurants, all of the menu boards outside had been, which normally show the Tageskarte, the day's menu, meal choices had been erased, and instead on every single one of the blackboards was written "Bravo America." So, which is typical, I think, what was going on all over Berlin and all over Germany and all over Europe and probably the world. There was just a sense of incredible relief and exhilaration and excitement, which has already begun to fade a bit, but the day after was truly, a universal.
And how much of it was just that we rejected the person who was perceived as the heir to Bush, and how much of it was that we elected a black candidate, and how much of it was that we elected this black candidate?
No, I think it was all three of those, Bob. Great contempt for Bush, obviously. Palin and McCain, essentially. I think McCain was seen here as a figure, as a respected figure, attention has been paid to his prisoner of war days and to his previous incarnation as a kind of independent Republican, somebody who would diverge from the Bush policy somewhat. But I think there was a lot of shared ridicule here in Europe for Palin. And a sense that the McCain campaign was people just watch this with incredible detail and are as sophisticated observers of the American political scene as the Americans themselves. So a great amount of attention paid to the kind of low road that McCain took. I think a lot of diminishing respect for him as a result, and also just tremendous excitement for who Barack Obama is, and also for the race factor, which I think was something that Germans in particular are mesmerized by, because Germany itself has such a difficult relationship with race here. I mean, you don't see very many black people here, but Germany has a very difficult relationship with immigrants and with Turks. Even Turks who've been here a couple of generations are not necessarily accorded citizenship status. So there is a great fascination for the phenomenon. Son of a Kenyan who passed briefly through the shores of the United States and then left again, for somebody like this to be elevated to the presidency, it's Germanized. It's just a remarkable thing, especially in comparison to the chances of a phenomenon like that happening here.
It's partly a social mobility story.
Yeah, of course. But it's Americans are fascinated by. I'm sorry, Germans are fascinated by American attitudes towards race, and as much as Americans are themselves. So then of course there's the constant comparison with Jack Kennedy and people remember both Kennedy's visit here in 1962 and was it 63, and the Barack Obama visit here in July, which was seen as a parallel. I mean, there was a sense of excitement back in July when he came here and spoke at the Ziegesäuler, the huge crowds that came out. He was really anointed as a Kennedy-esque figure back then.
And can I ask you, is it true what I heard that when Kennedy said, Ich bin ein Berliner, or whatever, that actually the literal translation of that is... are all hot dogs.
I am a donut. Now, supposedly I am a donut. I asked a lot of Berliners that question, actually. And I think it can, if the correct answer is that it can, in fact, be interpreted that way, but it's also correct what he said. So, no. The answer is he did not, in fact, tell millions of Berliners that he is a donut.
Okay. And did you go see Obama speak?
I did not go see Obama speak. I have a fear of large crowds of Germans. Even the draw. Maybe it's some vestigial thing in my ancestral past. But I did not. I'm afraid I missed that historic event. But regret it, actually.
Well, a fear of masses of Germans must be kind of a chronic problem if you live in Germany.
But you don't usually get, 200 or 300,000 of them in one place,
right,
except in soccer matches and American political rallies.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so now Obama as president will face various issues on the foreign policy front, and some of them involve countries you've been to, in fact, maybe almost all of them. I mean, I know last time we talked, you had been recently to Afghanistan. I don't know if you've been there lately.
I haven't been back there since March 2007, but I was interested to read C.J. Shivers' piece in the Times, I believe. I guess I read it in the Herald Tribune, must have run yesterday, about his visit to a forward operating base in a very hot corner of Afghanistan, because it really did resemble very closely the experience that I had when I was in Kunar province in November 2006, in a forward operating base very close to the Pakistani border. I also read Jane Perlez's piece today about what was going on the other side of the border near Kunar province, and the stepped up campaign against the Taliban there, and the incredible resistance that the Taliban are giving to the Pakistani army. So from what I have experienced and what I've been reading, it really seems like things have not gotten any better. In fact, have progressively worsened on both sides of the border, and then Obama is going to have a serious problem on his hands as the emphasis in the quote-unquote war on terror does seem to shift away from Iraq toward Afghanistan. And is Obama, if he does in fact make good on his plans to increase the number of troops it's going to be. I think you had sent me an email about the calling it, is this Barack's Vietnam? That's kind of the question of the hour, I suppose. There are a lot of signs that this thing's getting worse. The Karzai is completely ineffective. Sort of growing feeling of among U.S. policy people, including those surrounding Obama, I guess, that Karzai may not be the guy to back. Attacks inside Kabul, assassinations of Westerners. I mean, the city between my most recent visit there in March 2007 and from what I've heard from journalists and others who have been there in the last couple of months, dramatic. And in a way, it's kind of like comparing Baghdad 2003, immediate aftermath of the invasion, or say a couple of months after the invasion, to Baghdad 2005. So dangerous, you couldn't sit in restaurants, you couldn't stay in hotels. It seems like the same kind of downward progression is happening in Kabul, which was always considered to be a sanctuary.
Well, I know when you and I spoke, and you had been there recently, this is more than a year ago, but I forget, and maybe you took more than two trips there.
I took two trips there, actually.
But I remember at one point you were talking about how safe it was, how nice and cheap the hotel was.
I wrote a piece for the New York Times travel section, which you may or may not remember. I don't know who reads the travel section. But it was a cover story on Kabul as the development of tourism in Kabul.
Destination resort.
Serena Hotel had just opened up. I think the Aga Khan had paid for that. It was a big project, sort of seen as the as a sign of Kabul's return to normality, they were actually opening up a 5-star Serena, which is one of the finest hotel chains in Asia and the Middle East and Africa, in the heart of Kabul. Lovely place, stayed there a couple of nights. Not too many tourists, but, you know, definitely the place had potential. And I, of course, a year later, the Taliban invaded the place, killed something like, basically marched through the halls, shooting down every Westerner they found.
This is the hotel you had stayed at.
This is the hotel that I had stayed at. And that kind of was the beginning of the real end for Kabul as a place where Westerners would go out at night. When I was there in November and in March 2007, there was a place called the Kabul Coffee House, which was a regular, kind of the Starbucks of Kabul. Every evening there would be large gatherings of foreign aid workers and journalists passing through, local embassy types, expats lived in Kabul would come out and hang out, and there'd be poetry readings and movies, and it was kind of a very optimistic scene there. From what I understand, people don't go there anymore. It's considered too dangerous. The Taliban is supposed to be watching people who come in and out of there, following people home. So it's one of the many. It has become one of the, you know, many Western hangouts that are just now considered no-go areas.
Obama has been talking as if he might make Afghanistan his Vietnam in the campaign, but today there was an article in the, in terms of committing troops there, but today there was an article in the Washington Post about how he's plans to, well, first of all, do something that there's more and more talk about, which is finding the so-called reconcilable Taliban.
Right, exactly. I think I read that piece as well.
What is the definition of reconcilable? In other words, what would we ask of them? Would we say, okay, you can have the country if you will not shelter terrorists, if you will not shelter anti-American terrorists like Al-Qaeda?
Well, again, you're right to raise the question, who's the definition of reconcilable Taliban, or do they exist? I mean, I think that the idea, and I believe that General Petraeus has talked about this too, is to kind of follow the Sons of Iraq Concerned Citizens Council model that was followed, mm-hmm. where you identified sympathetic Sunni tribal leaders and appeal to them and turn them against Al-Qaeda. But I don't know if you have the same sort of dynamic going on in Taliban country, because the Pashtun nationalists and Taliban are because of the much stronger influence of fundamentalist Islam in these parts of this part of the world. And
right. I mean, the Sunni leaders that they did the deals with in Iraq were, by and large, not fundamentalists.
Fairly secular guys. That's true. And they viewed Al-Qaeda as... I was just in Samarra. We can talk about that as well. Up in the town, of course, infamous for the destruction of the Golden Dome, a real Sunni stronghold, you know, considered a stronghold of Sunni insurgency in 2005, 2006. In fact, Al-Qaeda took control of that town for about 2 years. Al-Qaeda basically ran the show there. But you had a distinctive split between the Al-Qaeda in Iraq extremists who were wielding power there and the Sunni militants who had originally found common ground with Al-Qaeda 2003-2004 against the occupation. But as time progressed, 2005, in fact, you began to see the Sunni militants turning against Al-Qaeda, kind of disgusted by public executions, by the implementation of Sharia law, by the extortion rackets that Al-Qaeda was running, and just by the general violence that the fundies were carrying out in the heart of the city with car bombs.
So in that case, the reconcilables were people who were sick of the mindless violence.
I don't know the country as well as I know Iraq. I mean, I hesitate to speak about the gradations of, fundamentalism and pro, but I think there's still in that part of the country that sort of Pashtun nationalism is so strong, it does go very hand in hand as well with Islamic fundamentalism. And there is, I think, more of a tolerance and acceptance for some of the philosophies of Al-Qaeda in that part of the world, especially with regard to, you know, killing the occupier. Mm-hmm. So it might be more formidable challenge.
Maybe the key is to separate the Pashtun nationalism per se from the fundamentalism.
You don't get the sense in that part of the world, and certainly not necessarily in the tribal areas of Pakistan, that you've got such a significant split there, you know. So it could be a greater problem. Although somebody who I respect a great deal, Rory Stewart, who I think you guys have even talked about getting on the show, has always said that there's no possible military solution. Rory Stewart being those of you who don't know, wrote a wonderful book about walking through Afghanistan. Lives in Kabul. Has spent the last several years in Kabul. A young British diplomat who probably knows the country as well as any Western.
And he's always believed
that there was no chance of any ceasefire. I remember sitting down with him in 2006, 2007, and hearing him say that any sort of military solution is just cannot work because the Pashtun population does not accept any sort of occupying force. The only way to do it, maybe you can do it with a well-trained Afghan army, but the idea of these American soldiers being plopped down in these fire bases and trying to tame an insurgency. I mean, I wrote this piece 2 years ago. I'm reading Shiver's piece in the New York Times today, and it doesn't look like there's any difference. You sort of wonder, what have we been doing out there? These American soldiers hunkered down in these isolated mountaintop bases, getting hammered by the Taliban, mortared, firing back, sometimes killing civilians, which, of course, has the opposite effect of what it
We just inadvertently did another wedding, right? I mean, it just seems like every couple of years we inadvertently bomb an Afghan wedding. We did it within the last week, I think.
I didn't realize we did it in the last week.
Yeah.
It happened
again, apparently.
I saw this happening, you know, in November 2006 in this very isolated, very exposed base which was surrounded by Taliban, where they were getting mortared every single day. And they were firing, heavy weaponry across the valley at the Taliban. Sometimes, I mean, they were claiming they were being careful, you know, using precision weaponry. But it's hard to argue that, you know, 120 millimeter shells, artillery, mortar is precision weaponry. You know? So it was hard for me to see in that. During that time frame when I was up there, that this strategy was really having any kind of effect.
Yeah, the other thing in this Washington Post article was that the Obama administration was maybe going to try to bring Iran in on the case.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that works exactly. What exactly they have to offer, except for maybe not causing trouble. But where else where have you been lately? Have you been to Iraq lately?
September.
That's pretty recent. And what was your take?
My take was that, I write about it in the New York Review of Books. It's out now. And I've got a piece also coming out of the Smithsonian about the rebuilding of the Golden Dome. But that was, an opportunity for me to get up to Samarra and see what was happening there. And on one level, you can definitely say that the improvements in Samarra are dramatic, and I think Samarra is a microcosm of dozens of other former hotbeds of the insurgency in Salahuddin province, which is around Tikrit, north of Baghdad, and also Baghdad itself, and the towns of Anbar province. That you have this radical Al-Qaeda insurgency that was controlling many of these towns. You had beginning in 2007, you had a kind of shift in the American approach. a new opening towards the Sunni militants, that is non-Al-Qaeda related militants, using the intelligence that these guys provided to pinpoint Al-Qaeda cells, go after them. At the same time, once the immediate threat had been quieted down, then they began to kind of seal off these cities and towns with earthen berms, with blast walls, with watchtowers, essentially creating these and a handful of checkpoints in and out. So they both kind of drove Al-Qaeda out of these towns and then made it extremely difficult for Al-Qaeda to get back in. Censuses of every single neighborhood so that you knew exactly who was living in what house.
Okay, we are back, we think, after a brief technical interruption. You were talking about Iraq and how the process by which it had gained some degree of stability and how these towns had been kind of pacified. And I guess I got the sense from you talking off the air that they remain, I think you said, kind of like maximum security prisons.
As I said, you've got three checkpoints in Samarra, and you've got three checkpoints. Everybody's got to pass through. You've got watchtowers, berms, patrols, neighborhoods broken up by blast walls. So intense security, very little freedom of movement, and yet you talk to people on the streets of Samarra and, you know, in individual neighborhoods. You've got kids out at night. Playgrounds, you've got contractors coming back, you've got bridges being built, some projects, buildings being repaired. The Golden Dome of Samarra is in fact being rebuilt now, a UNESCO project. So there are a lot of signs that, you know, in these pockets of stability, you've got business coming in and certainly a great improvement in quality of life for the people there, and that people do welcome it.
And what did you talk to anybody about what they thought the prospects were for the kind of relatively rapid withdrawal of American troops that Obama has talked about during the campaign?
Well, I think I did talk to people there, and there's a lot of nervousness, and a lot of that nervousness has to do with the still sort of unanswered question about what's going to happen to these 150,000 or so, I don't know what the exact number is, sons of Iraq, who are now playing pretty critical roles in Baghdad and Salahuddin province, basically in all of the Sunni areas of the country where the insurgency was raging 2 years ago. These guys, their fate has really not been determined. There's a great sense, as I write in this New York Review of Books piece, that a lot of distrust on both sides.
Now, are they the guys we kind of, I mean, not to put it too crassly, but kind of bought off?
Yeah,
I mean,
basically, these are the guys
who were the reconcilable.
Well, you know, it's fair to say that we bought them off, but at the same time, it's, you know, these guys weren't particularly happy with the way things were going. They had sort of made their, resistance known to the occupation, but at the same time, they were kind of horrified at the, I mean, Al-Qaeda was essentially a very powerful force there, and Sons of Iraq couldn't kick their butts alone. I mean, they needed the American, they needed American troops to do it for them. So it was just simply a question of mutual, besides cash. I mean, it was mutual interest,
an alignment of interest. Yeah. But they have not been integrated into the political process, and it's
not
clear how that's going to
happen. The Maliki government is very, very suspicious, verging on hostile towards these guys. I mean, it's an armed force that up to now has been essentially under the control of the American Army. And the idea is to gradually shift control to the Iraqi government, which, of course, is Shia-dominated. And so there's, you know, a great deal of suspicion on both sides. The idea is that the Shia government would absorb a lot of these guys into the security forces, would give them jobs in the police and the army. That really has not happened, the American Army, the American soldiers I spoke to were pretty worried about it. They said, especially in a place like Samarra, which was seen as the hotbed of the Sunni insurgency, a place where the Sunni militants basically destroyed the third holiest site in all of Shia Islam, there's a tremendous amount of antagonism shown from the Iraqi government, Shia-dominated government, towards the people of Samarra, and very little desire to do anything for them, including take some of these former Sunni insurgents and put them into the Iraqi police. So even though the police itself is a pretty is a very thin force in Samarra and really needs these kinds of guys, these fairly well-trained fighters, to fill the ranks, but Maliki doesn't want to do it. Certainly the Shia majority in the government has very little desire to do it. So it's kind of an impasse right now.
Yeah, so the thing, the people were saying back when that we started arming these guys, what some people were saying is, don't you realize you're just arming what is eventually going to be one side in a civil war? It sounds like that prospect has not quite been ruled out.
No, I don't think it has been ruled out. Some of the troops I talked to said they don't think that the leadership of the Sons of Iraq, the guys that they deal with on a daily basis, really want to return to the days of, full-scale civil war or any sort of insurgency, whether it's directed against the American troops or against the Iraqi government, against the Iraqi Shia-dominated army. But on the other hand, a lot of these low-level guys, fairly uneducated, frustrated, what happens when they get their, what's going to happen to them if they're fired? The Sons of Iraq, the numbers are going down, contracts are not being renewed, the Iraqi government putting an awful lot of pressure on the Americans to draw down this force. So if these guys are not employed, the American soldiers tell me, officers tell me, then I can see them laying IEDs again and picking up their guns and going back to some sort of low-level insurgency. So, nobody's really predicting we're going to go back to the days of 2006 there, post-Golden Dome horror, is that really what we want? Do we want to leave Iraq with a low-level insurgency still going on, led by these guys, these disenfranchised, disaffected former Sons of Iraq fighters, which is still, a good possibility.
So the Iraqi government, on the one hand, is pressing America to withdraw troops fairly briskly. On the other hand, it's the withdrawal of those troops that is going to help turn these Sons of Iraq into a threat to the Iraqi
potentially,
government.
Potentially, yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's a conundrum. And I guess the only real solution to this is for both sides, for Sunnis and Shias, to come to some sort of agreement. The two sides need to sit down, and there has to be a lot of all these years of mistrust. You've had 4 or 5 years of just open hostility between these two groups. Mm-hmm. And somehow that has to be, the legacy of this period has to be transcended somehow, and you've got to get the Maliki government willing to absorb a large number of these fighters into the Iraqi armed forces. And until that happens, or at least give them jobs in the public sector, whatever, until that happens, you're always going to have that threat. But there have been countless cases of promises being made by the Iraqi government to take X number of fighters from such and such a town, bring them in, and so far nothing's happened. I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that those fighters aren't being integrated.
Okay. Now, you've got, a big piece coming out in the Atlantic before long on, Lebanon and Syria, or what?
It's on the long-forgotten, overlooked assassination of Rafik al-Hariri, into the Prime Minister of Lebanon in 2005, who was blown up in a suicide car bomb on the storied corniche of Beirut.
And he was kind of anti-Syrian.
Exactly.
Syria had long had great influence on Lebanon.
It's quite an interesting and possibly well-timed piece, because what happened was the United Nations set up a tribunal to look into the assassination. And if you can remember back in 2005, when Syria was really not quite the axis of evil, but certainly the second tier axis of evil wannabe in the eyes of the Bush administration.
Although, just as an asterisk, I think not that long before that, we had been outsourcing torture to Syria.
Of course, sometime around. We do have an interesting relationship with the Syrians.
Anyway, okay, but
because on the one hand, there's a great, you know, the interesting thing about that regime, of course, it's an Alawite minority regime that has a great amount of hostility towards the suspicion towards Sunni extremists. At the same time, Assad is kind of closing his eyes to the rap line of
Al-Qaeda
and Sunni extremists coming down from Syria using it as a sanctuary into Iraq.
And wait, remind us, so Alawites are Sunni or Shiite? Because there's
they're not, they're somewhere in between, you know. I don't have my Alawite the details of my, I'm afraid it escapes me exactly where the Alawites fall, but they're definitely I believe they're an independent sect of Islam that fall possibly somewhere. Well, of course, we know that the Alawites that the Iranians and the Alawites have formed a long bond, long alliance that is partly inspired by a sort of hostility towards Sunnism. So I suppose they would lean more towards Shia. And if I get a lot of mail from people who are on my case about my ignorance, I apologize. But there's certainly no love lost between the Alawites and the Sunni. The Sunni majority in Syria looks upon the Alawites.
And in fact, Syria had been supporting Hezbollah, which was Shia.
Yes. Syria views Hezbollah as a means of continuing its proxy war against Israel. Keep the pressure on. Get the Golan Heights back. It's such a complicated web of alliances in this part of the world. And the piece is partly an attempt to unravel all that. But the main point is to show of the story is that the tribunal was set up to look into who was responsible for the assassination of Hariri. There was every indication in the early days of the investigation that Assad himself or his closest associates, including his brother-in-law and his brother, were involved in planning and executing the killing of Hariri, because Syria had long exercised tremendous control over Lebanon. Hariri began to assert a certain amount of independence for Lebanon. It got more and more forceful, and the theory is that they decided to knock him off in a sort of mafia-style hit. The sophistication of the operation certainly indicated it had to have big support from somebody. The Syrians were the most likely candidates. The first preliminary UN investigation pointed to Assad and his underlings. But then a strange thing began to happen over the last couple of years, which is that Assad went, that the U.S. kind of dropped its idea of regime change towards Syria. The Syrians began warming up to the West. You saw in the initiation of a sort of a detente with Israel, actual ongoing talks about the Golan Heights. You saw Assad being welcomed into the world community with this meeting earlier this year where he was welcomed by Sarkozy in France at a summit of Mediterranean leaders. So a sea change going on in Syrian politics. But meanwhile, you've got this UN tribunal here that has been pressing onward with this investigation that, according to insiders who I talked to, pretty much backs up the initial theory that Assad was behind it. So the UN has basically got this conundrum going on, as well as do the big powers, which is that they've empowered this UN tribunal to essentially finger the killers of Hariri. The result is likely to be something that nobody really wants to have. Mm-hmm. So, which is that, hey, Assad did it, or Assad's guys did it, and what happens? So there's a lot of stuff going on in the background.
There's the capacity for a kind of plea bargaining in these situations.
Well, exactly.
Right?
This is what happened in the Lockerbie case, which you remember Gaddafi was implicated as being possibly the master conspirator in the Lockerbie killings, bombing of the Lockerbie flight. 1988 over Scotland, 300
and we kind
killed.
Of said, if you'll straighten up and be a good citizen and
a lot of back channel negotiations went on. What happened was Gaddafi ended up pushing forward a couple of low-level Libyan intelligence agents, who one of whom was convicted of the crime and one of whom was found not guilty tribunal for a Scottish tribunal set up in Camp Zeit in the Netherlands, curiously enough just a couple of miles from where the UN Tribunal for the Lebanon killing is taking place. So a lot of people I talked to, including some very top-level Syrian politicians like Walid Jumblat, the head of the Druze there believe that there's no interest whatsoever by the United States, among all the powers, the U.S., France, Saudi Arabia, in really finding out who actually killed Hariri, but instead sort of finding some easy way out, some sort of compromise that is not that is going to leave the Syrian regime intact, because nobody at this point really wants to see Assad weakened. So long as he'll do business.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially.
Exactly.
I mean, this wasn't the case, Israel, of course, Iraq. You know, in 2005, he was our enemy. The
right.
Bush administration wanted him out, but, you know, as things always tend to happen in the Middle East, it's always a fluid situation.
Of course, meanwhile, we recently launched from Iraq a raid into Syria.
We did.
The service, ostensibly, of Iraqi war aims, and I assume that they were in that service, but there has been some speculation that there were elements in the, this is probably wild speculation, but that there were elements in the Pentagon who do not want to see rapprochement with Syria, don't like the kind of realpolitik, and wanted to sabotage it.
I think that that's probably accurate. I can't speak for internal Washington politics, but I don't think that everybody's on board with this idea that Assad is a good citizen. And that he is...
Or can be turned into one. I don't think anybody thinks he has been one, but the question is whether he's reconcilable.
Right, right. I think the whole idea of regime change that was talked about openly a couple of years ago, you know, maybe by the boards, but...
Yeah, now Obama, I think one thing we can... I think his foreign policy is still a little fluid, and I'm a little in the dark about how excited I should be about it, but I do think that there is going to be a fairly realist cast to it, which you started to see in the waning years of the Bush administration. And in fact, if he leaves Robert Gates on at defense, that will be, suggest a continuation of a kind of realist approach to foreign policy, which would argue for plea bargaining in this case.
Plea bargaining, yeah. I think he is the guy who's talking dialogue. And in my piece in The Atlantic, I do make the point that there's kind of a shared interest on everybody's part here, just about everybody involved. The UN, the Security Council, the Syrians, the Israelis, everybody except the pro-Hariri faction in Lebanon. But they don't really count anymore, you know. Is that a plea bargain is the best way out of here? Way out of here, some sort of interview. Condi Rice has already said a few months ago that would never happen, that the UN integrity of the tribunal would never be questioned, would never be interfered with, the UN process would never be interfered with, but it's highly, highly possible.
Well, hasn't there already been some suggestion, or am I getting this mixed up with another UN case? Didn't some UN official make some kind of overture about this, suggesting moving in the direction of a plea bargain, or am I completely wrong?
I'm not sure if I've heard anybody openly, any UN figure openly talk about that. I think King Abdullah of Jordan, I mean, a few big politicians, leaders have raised the idea of some sort of immunity deal for Assad. I think the UN is still trying to maintain this idea of being independent. Investigative unit that cannot be in the power, susceptible to the influence of politics.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting. My guess is that this whole thing is going to be dragged out anyway for years, and then I hope that it's supposed to start in January. UN Secretary General was recently, as July, was talking about a January beginning to this. That's in fact why our piece is coming out when it is. But it remains to be seen. I think a lot of people are hoping it'll just be forgotten.
It would sure be nice to get some deals done in the Middle East, I gotta say. I mean, you know, and you're seeing kind of hopeful signs. I mean, one is that Syria and Israel have been talking for some time now.
Things are looking a lot better in the Middle East than when I left Jerusalem in 2000, at the end of 2004. I mean,
really?
No question. Things were, at that point, I would say, just about as bad as one could possibly imagine. Well,
but you're talking about relations among states, not so much conditions in the West Bank and Gaza.
Yeah, but of course, conditions in the West Bank and Gaza were so awful, and the insurgency in Iraq was so was accelerating, that it right. affected all, and Lebanon was, Syrian troops were occupying Lebanon. You had Hariri at that point, raising, the hostility between those two states was great. Everything was inflamed at that time.
Yeah.
So things have definitely calmed down. There's a sense of growing stability right now.
And if you could work things out among the states, it would radically increase the prospects for a solution to the Palestinian problem.
If you could get a Golan Heights deal, Israeli-Syrian deal, which is not completely preposterous, that would also kind of derail Hezbollah. Hezbollah would have to be swept up in that kind of an arrangement. And then theoretically, that would apply not only to Israel and Syria, but also bring Lebanon in, which would mean that Israel's long no more enemies surrounding Israel. The last two enemies of Israel, implacable enemies, would be neutralized. And
that would be nice.
That would be pretty interesting.
And Ehud Olmert, the outgoing prime minister of Israel, said some really I think almost path-breaking things on the anniversary of Yitzhak Rabin's assassination yesterday, the day before or something. I gather he was the first prime minister to say we need to withdraw to the pre-1967 borders, with, of course, the exception of some territory swaps in cases where there's just, an irreversible amount of settlement. But I think I read that he was the first prime minister to use that phrase as the goal, the pre-1967
border. Yeah, I'm not sure. The Camp David agreement, the attempted agreement at Camp David was not, I'm not sure about Ehud Barak's wording there, what the offer was exactly.
I'm not sure that was on the record in any of
right,
it, right?
Right.
I mean, we only know Camp
unclear.
David from reports after
course,
the fact. So this was a public pronouncement. So who knows? Maybe things aren't hopeless.
Don't seem as hopeless as they once did, that's for sure.
No,
and
they
Obama
don't.
Maybe, who knows? Obama is, it'll be interesting to see whether Obama's identity, how already you're getting some positive signs from the Middle East about him, about his ascension. So it could be a great opportunity. Yeah.
Ascension is kind of, one of the memes the McCain camp was trying to spread around was that we thought of him as the Messiah. So maybe ascension is not the word.
Right, yes.
Maybe ascendancy or something.
Imam Hussein Obama, yes.
The hidden, yeah. Well, so so anyway, this is, so we're ending on a note of hope. I'm just thinking, yes, we can, Josh. Yes, we can.
I am definitely not as, of course, everything's hunky-dory in the Middle East. Where does that put people like me? Recession in the U.S., no stories, no news. What happens to somebody like me? We're the people who thrive on instability and uncertainty, so.
Yeah.
I do feel pretty strongly that things are stabilizing in that wretched corner of the world, and that I don't see any real fault lines opening in the near future. So that's a good sign.
Wow. Yeah, and you're not known for your optimism,
not really.
I recall.
But we still have Afghanistan. The Afghanistan-Pakistan thing.
Yeah, there is that.
That's an intractable hellhole.
And Pakistan
does
have. Pakistan does have nuclear weapons,
yes.
And we would hate to
yes.
see that country
so
fall into the hands of radicals.
Okay.
That's too bad. And also, I got to say, now that I realize that your career is on the line, I'm kind of ambivalent about the dawning of world peace
I'll
anyway,
find
Josh.
Something else. I really don't know. Maybe it's time for me to start going to nice places for a change, write travel stories about Berlin or Estonia. Who knows?
Why don't you try that?
Yeah.
But meanwhile, people can see your work in the New York Review of Books right about now, and then what, in a couple of weeks in the Atlantic Monthly?
Summer
or something?
Atlantic Monthly. And,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, they will do that. Avid readers comprise our audience. So thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Bob.
And we'll do this again.
All right. Great. Take care.
Okay. See you.